There are certain things that are going to be offered or sometimes even pushed or just done to your baby the second that they're born. All of the information about what can happen in that first 24 to 48 hours of your baby's life. Have it in your birth plan and spoken with your, like, your provider, your doula if you have one, your partner if you have one, and get everybody on the same page. Welcome back to Healthy as a Mother. I am your co-host, Dr. Morgan McDermott, and this is the show for becoming and being a mother, where Dr. Leah and I share our natural health and motherhood guidance that you've been looking for through our fresh, functional, and balanced lens. And today, you are going to learn a crash course in all of the different things that you need to know about newborn interventions. These are decisions that you need to talk about with your partner and your birth team before your baby is born, because as you will see in this episode, many of them take place within seconds or hours of your baby's birth. And you really want to be informed on the pros, the cons, what happens if we do nothing. And this episode is exactly that. It's like a whole entire course on what could or could not happen with your baby. My recommendations on each one. Do I think we should not? What are the situations and the nuances there? And I think you're really going to enjoy. So get ready to take some notes, take out a paper and pen, send it to your people. And you're going to want to have a discussion about all these different things with them. Because there's a lot to learn here. So here we go.
Okay. We are going to hear from the brilliant Dr. Morgan all about newborn interventions and the things that you need to think about when you are pregnant, the decisions that you're going to have to make. I feel like people ask these questions all the time, and I've never really known where to direct them to understand all of these things. And so you are going to break down these complicated things that people feel confused about, that there's lots of misinformation out there and a lot of different opinions. So why don't you just take us away?
Okay, great. So this topic was spurred from a conversation on Instagram stories, which I'm often in my Instagram stories going on various rants. You'll learn a lot. You'll also see my personal life there. So if you don't follow my stories, you need to. And it kind of, the conversation went wild, like lots of DMs, and I realized we don't have an episode to point back to with all of the information about what can happen in that first 24 to 48 hours of your baby's life. So this is applicable whether your baby is born at the hospital, at home, in a birth center, maybe, I guess, unless you're free birthing. But otherwise, there are certain things that are going to be offered or sometimes even pushed or just done to your baby the second that they're born. And you need to have it in your birth plan and spoken with your, like, your provider, your doula if you have one, your partner if you have one, and get everybody on the same page that this is what, how we want to manage these things. Obviously also intersecting how the birth goes with, like, reality, the reality of how the birth goes with what your goals and plans are, because if something emergent is happening or whatever, then some of this might have to pivot and change, and that's okay too. But you need to have, like, thought about, okay, well, how could we do this the best way possible? How can we still do a little bit of delayed cord clamping during a cesarean, as long as it's not an emergency cesarean and the baby's not doing well, blah, 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 you know, whatever. Okay. So we have, let's see, how many things? We have 18 things. No, we have 14 things to talk about. And I'm going to go through some of them really fast because they're pretty self-explanatory. And then some of them go a little bit more, a bit deeper. And if you like this episode, if you like what you're hearing and the way that I educate, I have an entire pregnancy, birth, breastfeeding, and postpartum class called the 6-Week Pregnancy Call, which will be rebranded at some point. But right now, that's still what it's called. You can find it on my website, milkmedicine.com, or you can find it in the show notes of this episode. And it is where I teach you all of the things that you need to know about pregnancy. Like, this is just one slice of newborn interventions. Okay. There are maternal interventions. There are blah, blah, blah. You know, there's so many different things to know when you're becoming a mom. And if you have the lens of wanting integrative or natural health layered on top of that, that is where I'm kind of like your girl. So check out that class if you're into this, because it's the holy grail. It's my, like, main offering. I run it 4 times a year. Okay. So the first one is going to be, you know, the first thing to happen. Now, I'm not talking about birth interventions like forceps, vacuum. We're kind of starting right at the baby is born. We're hitting the ground running from there. So delayed cord clamping. This luckily is sort of standard of care now in most places, but there is a wide variety of opinions on what the delay means. And so some practitioners are going to count to like 30 and then they're going to clamp it. Or they'll say, it's been 1 minute or 2 minutes, or oh, it looks mostly white or whatever. And so you will need to, first of all, decide on what you would prefer it to be. Do you want to wait and birth the placenta and keep the baby and the placenta attached for a little while, just, for the heck of it, for pictures, for the experience of it, for extra delay in the cord, why cut it, blah, 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 whatever. So the good thing is that it's to some extent will be protected for you, but you still do need to have this conversation. Also know that if you're wanting to cord blood bank, so you want to take some of the baby's cord blood, bank it away for future medical things, or you want to do some further testing on it or something, you will have a harder time managing how much time can be delayed cord clamping going into the baby versus then now needing to milk it out of the cord and collect. And so usually what they say is like you can do 45 seconds to maybe 1 minute maximum of delayed cord clamping going to baby, and then after that clamp it and take the remaining for your blood banking, but knowing also that you may not get enough. So I don't talk about cord blood banking here. I feel like it's a kind of a rare thing for people to choose anyway. And I am pro, giving the baby their blood.
But I do want to make a note because I had two hospital births that you do need to ask what the definition of the hospital is by their delayed cord clamping. Because I remember going to the hospital and asking these things. And they're like, oh, yeah, no, we totally do it. I think 30 seconds was their delayed cord clamping. And they were like really proud of it and excited. And that's wonderful. Like it's better than zero, but that's very different than 3 minutes or whatever. So even if they're like, oh, yeah, we do that, you can't just automatically think in your mind that they delay as long as you want them to. So.
Yeah, and at the birth too, like I've been at births where the practitioner was going to start to cut the cord and is just sitting there. So it's like if it's in a hospital, baby's up on mom's chest, the parents are having their moment and the practitioner is just kind of like sitting there, usually in a chair, waiting at the perineum of the woman. And they're very like they can be pretty impatient sometimes. And sometimes they're looking at their watch. They're literally counting down the seconds, like, when can I just get this going and be finished here? And like, do I need to do any stitching? Do I blah, blah, blah. So, and I had to be like, hey, no, we're not ready yet. And he kind of, I was the doula. So he was sort of combative with me and was like, well, look, it's mostly limp. And I was like, no, let's wait a couple more minutes. We want to do a good long delay. So have your doula be ready for that conversation too. I would say, like, after 5 minutes, there's probably very little extra blood that's getting into your baby. But also, why? Like, the practitioner can be told, don't cut it. I want to birth the placenta and just keep them attached. Like, who cares? Why? Like, if you wanted to just make it easy, they're going to think that's wackadoo. And you just say, okay, cool. Your opinion's interesting. And this is what I want to do. Okay.
You're finished. Yeah.
Now at home, this is like this conversation is so much different, and at birth centers, midwives really, really respect this. They don't see an issue to clamp the cord. I mean, birthing the placenta and keeping baby attached in those two settings is very, very common if the woman wants to, or it's like just a good long delay of 10, 15 minutes or something like that. Okay, and here's the thing is that there is some idea, some thought that maybe stem cells migrate a little bit slower, and the longer that they're kept attached, there's maybe more stem cells that are going from the cord into the baby, and there's a benefit there. Don't know if that's, been proven or shown, but there's certainly no harm. Okay, one thing I will say is that there are myths going around that have been going around for years that if you wait too long, and actually I've heard some practitioners say this too. If you wait too long, the blood will go back from the baby back into the cord of the placenta, like as if it retro
Oh,
flows,
really?
which it does not. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my whole life. Like, it's so dumb. It's so dumb in every single way. It does not go back into the cord and the placenta. Like, what in the world? And we'll get there later, but delayed cord clamping may contribute very insignificantly to jaundice levels. But ACOG and the Academy of Pediatrics have still said the benefits of delayed cord clamping with hemoglobin levels and iron stores being higher at 3 to 6 months of age trump any kind of potential minor increase in what's going on with jaundice levels. And we'll talk more about that too. So, okay, That's the first thing. Number two is rubbing and suctioning. So you'll often see videos where a baby is born, they're placed up on mom's like belly or chest, depending on the cord length. Because if the cord is really short, they can't get all the way up to mom's chest. And sometimes that's actually like a really surprising thing for women. They're like very like, wait, what? Because you it's awkward. It's awkward to not be able to pull them all the way up to your chest. And it just, if you can't, you can't. It's okay. Like, but know that that's a thing. Sometimes the cord is too short and you have to just kind of keep them down on your stomach. And I can imagine a scenario, I would be this way. If that was my scenario, I've never had that short of a cord where I couldn't, they were on my stomach. But I can imagine my selfish wishes and wants and needs to pull my baby up to my chest and like kiss them and be, smell them and be like really, really close to their face would probably elicit me to cut the cord a little shorter or a little sooner because I want that freedom of movement. So just being honest there. Like, 2 or 3 minutes,
Love
okay,
it.
fine. Like,
Being so
let's
honest.
go. I want to snuggle my baby. Okay, but the rubbing and the suctioning is such an aggressive and also like old school thing. It is a natural inherent thing. A mother will rub her own baby and stimulate her own baby and talk to her own baby. Sometimes moms are a little bit like in shock or, they're having that pause, that birth pause where they just are taking a second. And maybe baby needs to be stimulated a little bit, but also baby is getting oxygen through the placenta. We need to remember that it's okay. There's a couple of minutes of wiggle room here before baby needs to take their first breath for sure. So, all of that I think needs to be chilled out. Like, if the baby is coming to, why are we suctioning? Like, what suctioning needs, in my opinion, to be a total case by case basis. And if we do need to suction the baby because they're having a hard time, then sure. Also, a lot of mothers will instinctively, inherently, naturally, if they were left alone, they would suction their own babies and just suck it out of their nose and mouth with their mouth, which I know sounds gross, but it's not when it's your baby. You don't give a shit, okay? You love this thing. You would lick its eyeballs if you could. And you seriously. And so just the automatic towel rubbing, the baby's getting super jarred, and then the suction's going in the nose or in the mouth. And it's just like, and they're rubbing down the face, and the baby's wailing, crying. Like, why? Why? What are we doing? Like, the baby's crying. We don't need to be doing that. Now, a baby that is born limp and floppy and gray or white and is not coming to, yeah, we stimulate a little bit, or we encourage mom. Better yet, we encourage mom, rub your baby, talk to your baby, like, come on, kiss him. Like, let's get a little pat pats. Let's rub. Because that stimulation at the back does help them take that first breath. And sometimes if they do have too much gunk going on in their mouth and stuff, then they need a little suctioning. But again, it doesn't have to be so immediate. Like the sense of urgency of when a baby is born sometimes in the room, and particularly in a hospital setting, I feel like it just always, it's just routine. They're not able sometimes to look at every single baby individually. And it's like, so, what does a woman do? Okay, maybe you put it on your birth plan or you talk to the team and you say, hey, we don't need to do that unless we need to.
Is there a harm to the suctioning, or you're saying that like it just takes the baby away from mom?
There can be harm. Well, they can do the suctioning on mom's chest too, but it's just like a lot of jarring for them to be experiencing potentially unnecessarily. And oftentimes it seems like it's unnecessary because the baby is breathing. And w there's a very delicate, very, very important process going on in the heart and the circulation of the baby's newborn body as they're taking those first breaths of air. And it's really a sacred time where we should be not interrupting them as much as we possibly can. We should allow them to have this transition on mom's chest in as much peace and quiet as we can. But yeah, there is some harm with suctioning that it can, kind of like vasovagal them a little bit, or it's not terrible. I mean, it's a pretty low intervention. It's more just like, why are we doing this? Like, why? Like, let's pretend you're coming up for air from a free dive and like probably you're going to be fine and you're just going to take a deep breath, but like what if at the surface of the water there was people like waiting there for you and they just like were sticking things in your mouth and they were just like suctioning and like rubbing you with a towel and stuff, and it's like, wait, why don't we just hold on for like 15 seconds and just wait and see what happens, and if the person needs a little help then we give them a little help,
Yeah,
but
that makes sense.
it's the flip-flop in philosophy that you can see a parent in the systems of birth. Like, do we wait and see? No, that's a midwifery approach. They like attack and like do, it's like do all the things like really quickly and not wait and see. And I don't know. Anyway, okay. As we're talking about birth and postpartum support, I want to share an underrated tip with you. That tip is to continue taking your prenatal. Pregnancy and postpartum are the most nutritionally demanding phases of a woman's life. Many women stop taking their prenatal after birth, but we recommend taking it for at least the first 9 months postpartum or the entirety of the time that you're breastfeeding. My favorite prenatal is Needed's Prenatal Multi, and it's the most robust formula that I've seen in the market. It contains bioavailable nutrients in their evidence-based dosages, well above the bare minimum that a lot of prenatals settle for. Their quality standards are top tier with transparent third-party testing, and over 10,000 practitioners now recommending the brand. And now we have the results from their IRB-approved clinical study that confirm the results of what we've been seeing clinically. Women who take the prenatal multi have significantly higher blood levels of critical nutrients for pregnancy and postpartum. This includes vitamin D, B6, B12, riboflavin, vitamin K2. Only women in the Needed group reached the adequate, sufficient levels of vitamin D. Vitamin D plays a big role in your immune health, your mood, and your energy production, all things that are really important during your postpartum season. And while there's many different ways that you can support yourself postpartum, continuing to take your prenatal is a really simple, easy way to cover all your bases. It's one of the most impactful habits that we can have, and Needed makes it easy. Learn more about the study at thisisneeded.com/thrive and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Yes, healthy mother, like a little affirmation for yourself. Another one in this same realm is the swaddle and the hat. Like it was very common back in the day, and this is a little bit less common now, although still present, depending on your hospital, depending on how like progressive your hospital is and stuff. But it used to be that the baby was, okay, it used to be like this. Everybody pretty much was an episiotomy was cut. Oh my gosh, if I could speak. Back in the day, an episiotomy was cut on almost everybody. The baby was born. The second the baby was born, clamp, clamp, cut. Okay. So like blood is spewing out of the cord onto the table from the baby's blood that, it should go to them, but it's been already cut. The baby is put up on mom's belly or chest or even just immediately whisked away and rubbed down on like the little nursery bed thing and swaddled in hat and then handed back to mom. And it's just like if you were to ask them, why do you do that? What is the reason that we're doing that? They would probably say things about like thermoregulation, maybe. I honestly don't know. I so wish we could go back in time and interview some people in the obstetric history because it is a dark and wild history. That's not a dark and wild. That's like, light gray compared to what used to happen. But still, it's like this makes no sense. If there is a thermoregulation issue of a baby, which, yeah, they do have thermoregulation things. Where's the best place for them to be? Is skin to skin on mom's chest with a blanket on top, so that, I mean, we know this. You're out on a hike and you get caught up and it's raining and storming and you're gonna have to stay the night there and you're with a friend and you have to get naked and be skin to skin in order to survive the night because that's the best way for both of you to thermoregulate. And we know this about babies too. And it would be the natural thing you think about. What did a mother do, however many X thousands of years ago, in the bush? Giving birth to a baby, they weren't like wrapping them up in leaves and then holding them. They were just holding their naked little bodies to them. And I don't know, it's just like we overcomplicate things. So I am not a fan of the immediate swaddle and hat. I am a fan of skin to skin. And even if your baby's born cesarean, if they can't do skin to skin with you, they can do skin to skin with a partner or a doula or someone else who's in the room so that they're still getting that sort of that bonding, but also it's a much more effective thermoregulation. Now the hat.
Well, and don't they say that the things, like many of the things, the distress that babies have often will go away if they're just put on their mom's
Yes.
body skin to skin.
Yes. And it's like kangaroo care stuff with twins and little NICU babies and stuff. What do we know? They do so much better when they are with their twin or with their moms. I mean, you can't ignore the stats around any of that. And it just also makes logical sense. Sometimes I feel like humans have such a need for science to prove like very obvious things to us. Okay.
Or just like we are better. Our interventions are always better, and it's not at all the case most
Yeah,
of the
than
time.
nature, right? And with the hat, I'm not a fan of the hat either. Again, your baby's going to be plenty warm being a skin to skin on you, and there are pheromones that are coming out of the top of the baby's head that are purposeful for mom to be smelling. There is an oxytocin bonding loop happening, whether or not you don't perceive it or smell it. I mean, I think newborns smell amazing, but and most people do think their own newborn smells amazing. There's just There's just no reason. I mean, I guess unless you're outside and it's cold. Like, why? Let's let our baby just have their head free and smell it and kiss it and bond and lick your baby and just become absolutely obsessed with them and allow this beautiful hormonal oxytocin bath to overwash you. The physiology of that
And so this
is.
would be right when they're born, but if you are, let's say, leaving the hospital and going outside and it's winter, then
Sure.
you would put a hat on.
Sure. Yes. I'm talking like in the immediate moments after birth. Yeah.
Got it.
Okay. Similar to this, we're just segueing in. So we're going in chronological order of what's going to be offered and what's happening. So the golden hour and like this newborn physical exam, you know, taking the weight, the measurements, doing the whole physical exam thing. So golden hour is the second that that baby comes out of you through that first hour. And ideally, you are just left alone with them and you are able to be skin to skin, latch at some point in that first hour, you know, latch them for the first time, or try to. I mean, some babies are not as interested than others, and that's okay. Don't like make yourself wrong if they don't seem like they want to, but most babies will root around and like and seem interested. But you know, there's this sense of urgency to do this whole exam and weigh them and measure them and you know, whatever, do the whole thing. And it just does not have to happen right then. It doesn't have to. There is, again, this very delicate, sensitive window that why can we not honor that? If something's obviously very wrong with the baby and they need resuscitation or something, then yeah, we're doing that. But if it's all normal and dandy, this window should be protected. And it's becoming more of a thing where it is. And they will delay that newborn exam for, you know, a couple hours later. It doesn't have to happen right away. And even when it does happen, it can happen like right next to you. They don't have to take them away to somewhere else. There is some research that shows the most accurate weight is actually done at 24 hours post-birth, because if there was any IV fluid, you know, during IV fluid use during the birth, which would happen if you had an induction with Pitocin, if you had an epidural, or if you had a cesarean, or if you were just dehydrated. Sometimes people just give IV fluids, even though there's no other medications. That can affect the weight of your baby. And so we are most accurate at the 24-hour point, but that's not going to happen in most situations. They're going to take the weight at some point within the first couple hours of baby's birth. But we just, again, there's not an urgency unless there's something wrong with a baby. So that can be
Love that.
delayed. But that is a very important exam. I would not skip the exam. I would just delay it. They're looking at every system of your baby. They're checking their whole physical body, they're checking their nerve, their like reflexes, their nerves, their tone, their every single thing. Yeah, I'm a big fan. Just don't necessarily, you know, does it doesn't have to happen at minute 16 of them being born. Okay. Now, another intervention that they're going to offer, you know, within 1 to 2 hours of birth is the vitamin K injection. It is not a vaccine, it is an injection of vitamin K because babies are born with physiologically low levels of vitamin K. We don't really know why. We think it probably has to do with stem cell migration and movement to go to any places that were damaged during birth or something like that. We don't really know. There is a condition called vitamin K deficiency bleeding of the newborn that will kill or severely harm some newborns. There's an early version and there's a late version of it. And so the injection is given to every single baby unless you do something different to prevent this from happening. It's a pretty innocuous, benign intervention overall. There is a black box warning that people love to talk about, and I get it. We should be concerned when there's a black box warning. Okay, but we need to read that black box warning. And what it says is that, yeah, it can cause anaphylaxis and death in a baby if it's given intravenously. And it's not, it's given intramuscularly. Okay. So, any good person who knows anything about giving an injection, when you insert the needle, you pull back on the plunger to make sure you're not in a capillary or an artery or something like that. Chances are very low, but sometimes it happens. If you see blood when you pull back, you go, oops, okay, good thing I did that. And then you inject into a different site. But if they pull back on the plunger, there's no blood, then they will inject it into the muscle. That black box warning is unlikely to happen. There are people who report that they think that things happen because of the vitamin K injection. It's possible. I mean, it's still a medication, it's still an intervention. And so, yeah, you need to be informed. You need to know the benefits and the risks. The chances of something bad happening to your baby from having low vitamin K are very, very, very low. Luckily, thank goodness. The chances of something negative happening because of the injection are probably also similarly very, very, very low. But you need to be able to take the responsibility as a functioning adult and say, I accept this risk and not that risk, and so I'm going to make this choice. Okay, most parents are going to say, I wouldn't be able to live with myself if something negative happened to my baby because I didn't give them the option of, or like, I didn't give them the medication. But some aren't going to be like that. But there is an oral option too. You can give the oral vitamin K, which now bypasses this, injectable medication risk. And there are no known risks of oral vitamin K that I'm aware of, other than potentially it being a little bit less effective in that catching that early vitamin K deficiency bleeding window, but it's effective for the later on window. And the dosing of that would look like this. You do 2 milligrams of an oral vitamin K. The brands that I like are either Biotics Research makes one called Bioemulsion K, and then Dr. Green Mom makes one called Natal K. They're basically the same thing, but those are the two that I'm familiar with. And you would do two milligrams at birth, like the first day of birth, and then you do 1 milligram every week after that for 12 additional weeks. One dose, one time a week for 12 weeks. So the hard part about this for parents is compliance and remembering. So you need to have some kind of alarm on your phone or alarm on your calendar system that's going to remind you because you will not remember otherwise. You dose it with a feed. There's other information that you can get. I won't go into all of it there about vitamin K, but the oral option is there. Now, we'll talk about this in a second too, but with circumcision, a lot of practitioners will not accept an oral option in order to do a circumcision. They must or they require you to have done the injectable version. There is a preservative-free injectable version, which most hospitals will carry and birth centers and home birth midwives. And so you can request that if you'd like, and just like a single dose instead of a multi-dose vial. And okay, so that's that. Another one is hepatitis B vaccine. So this is a
Well,
vaccine.
hang on.
Oh, yeah.
Can I just say something
Yes.
about the vitamin K? And for people listening, I know it's so hard. I had a cousin who lost a baby, and they said it was because she didn't do the vitamin K shot. And so that was in my mind when I had my kids. But you can also choose some interventions and not others, right? Like, I think there's some ideas out there, and like the crunchy world especially, that if I'm gonna be crunchy, then I'm gonna be crunchy in every single thing. And like, you can absolutely pick and choose certain things, and it can be different for each child. I know for Avia, we did the oral K, but then with Cade, he was super bruised coming out. They like had to yank him out of me in the C-section. I mean, he was a huge baby coming out of a teeny tiny area. And again, you have to ask yourself those questions of what am I okay living with? And is the harm of this? They had preservative-free injections at the hospital. So, because the doctor told me, which who knows, it could just be fear-mongering, but he said that the oral does not actually work very well because it's all about the gut microbiome, and that has to establish. And maybe that's why it's better for the long-term one and not the short-term one, because he said if you don't have specific bacteria that are established yet in the baby's colon, that the oral is not going to work much at all. And he sees that all the time, and people don't really understand it, and they're misinformed. And it's like he sees, issues all the time when people don't do the injection. And it's so hard to know. It's like they're presented with this information. You're so vulnerable. But who knows if that's true or not. But it's like we decided to do the injection for our son because he had already had bruising. And it was just like, okay, I could never live with myself if I, didn't choose this. But we did choose the preservative-free option. So it's like the better of the two. And so it is sometimes a scale or a spectrum, and it's not always black or white, and it's not always the same for every choice and decision. And so it's just something I want to bring up that it can depend on what you're feeling in that moment, even just intuitively. Like you might have had your heart set when you walked in to not get it, like me. And then intuitively, I was just like, you know what? Actually, I think I do want it. And where did that intuition come from? I don't know. Was it from fear from the doctor? Was it from fear from thinking about my cousin? Or was there a reason that I was like, actually, I think I do want to do this? It's so hard to know. But at the end of the day, you need to know the pros and the cons for you to even have an informed decision or an intuitive hit one way or another. So I think that that's so helpful.
No, thank you for sharing that. It's so important because sometimes people can be really all or nothing. They're like, we're not going to do anything. And I quoted it in a different episode recently. I forget which one, but I saw somewhere somebody saying like to have blind compliance and trust in a system and just go along with everything they say is the same mindset as denying everything. The same core mindset is fear. Like denying every single thing because you're like, no, it can't be good. There can be no good reaped from this system is incorrect and still so dogmatic on the opposite end, but with the same core value that you're functioning from, which is fear. So don't do that because you can definitely make informed choices and it be different for each baby, as you said. And yeah, I didn't really talk about that, but it's so true. The way that the birth goes can matter a lot for this if you're trying to decide between oral and injectable. So I would say it does make sense that the oral would be a slightly less effective version, but there is a huge study that was done in Denmark looking at the difference between oral prophylaxis versus injectable, and there was no difference seen in the two groups. There was no incident, higher incidence of the vitamin K deficiency bleeding. And so that's where that particular regimen comes from that I stated. There is other regimens seen in different parts of the world, but this, because this one has this good study, that's why I suggested it. The oral microbiome thing is for like just natural vitamin K production. Yes. And that's true. And that's why it does take some time. And then breast milk is low, but you know, if we're giving still, we're giving an oral vitamin, it's going to increase serum levels in that time because it's still been supplemented. So yeah, it's not coming from the baby's microbiome, but it's being supplemented to them, and then it can still like, you know, take this. My problem with the injectable is that it's such a high dose. I wish that there was less vitamin K in it, but it's like, okay, well, you know, so yeah, it does make baby's blood thicker, yes. And you know, is there a problem with that? Like, not that we've been able to see, but it does work really well in preventing vitamin K deficiency bleeding. So, okay, then the next one is hepatitis B, which is a vaccine, and they're going to want to give that to your baby within 24 hours of birth. So it may not be within just those first couple of hours, but at some point in that first day, they're going to offer it. This does totally make sense if the mother has hepatitis B and is positive, or if there is an immediate caregiver that's going to be interacting with the baby a lot who's also, excuse me, vitamin B, or sorry, hepatitis B positive. Hepatitis B is transmitted via blood or like sexual fluids. So if there was a situation where there could ever accidentally be a blood related exposure to the baby, that's when, yeah, it's like, okay, we need to think about this. Because if a baby gets hepatitis B as an infant, the chances of it becoming a chronic lifelong problem are like extremely high, like 98%. It's not really as treatable as some of these other things if they end up getting it. And so that's one of the reasons why. But the second reason why is that hepatitis B is something that the at-risk population is going to be like in the early preteens and onward from when they're sexually active, or maybe they're getting into intravenous drugs. And so the worry is that, okay, we need to have this be on the childhood schedule starting first day of life to give some level of protection in case these people aren't like coming back for their regular pediatrician appointments. And now, you know, when they're in their at-risk phase, they're unprotected. And so let's bolster them all up as like little babies, even though it's not really an applicable disease at that time. So you know, it's all public health. Like, it's public health is anti-individual health. Individual health is anti-public health. Like, the two cannot coexist together very well. And that's just a fact, okay? There's going to be pros and cons of both. And it's really hard. I get why epidemiologists do and say and think the things that they do. I also get why, you know, patient care doctors get and say and do the things they do. It's difficult. So, there's that. Okay, number seven here is the erythromycin eye drops. So the eye goop. People are like, what is that? Okay, it's an
Okay, wait,
antibiotic.
hang on. But you only talked about the pros of Hep B. Is that something
Oh,
like, are there cons of
yes.
that? Is that
Okay.
something that like you just recommend everybody get?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Thanks. Okay. No, so I do not recommend this one. No. Yeah. I skipped half that. Okay. I do not recommend getting hepatitis B vaccine at birth if there isn't an immediate caregiver, including mom, having he had a hepatitis B known exposure or a known infection, because it is one of the higher aluminum containing vaccines. It's not going to be titrated in dose, whether your baby weighs 6 pounds or 10 pounds. And it's just like, why? Why do we need to do this? Why are we giving this big immune response the very first day of life? Again, as I've said, there are so many things going on for a newborn baby coming onto this planet. It's just not, if we don't need it, why are we doing it? You know, these things are not without potential harm. It can be given later. It can be on the schedule for later. And so, yeah, no, I am not a fan of this. Vitamin K, I am a fan of. I say we need to give vitamin K of some kind. But that also is coming from my personal bias of I would not be able, I've done different things with my kids. There has been some of my kids who'd got no vitamin K. There's been one who had half the injection, two that had some level of oral, one that had nothing. I think I intended to, and then I just didn't. I don't know. I got like distracted. I forget. I don't know. But now and as you become more experienced and you work with more people and you hear stories and you start to your opinions change on things. And there's somebody that I know in our community who's had an infant with a vitamin K deficiency bleeding event that almost killed her son. It was extremely shocking and scary, and there was no risk factor. It's just like, wow, that can happen to anybody. That's kind of wild. Why would I not just give this like very easy, safe thing to prevent that ha from
Right,
happening?
versus like hepatitis B, where if you know you don't have it and you're not having sex or doing drug needles with hepatitis B people, then it's like you know you don't have the risk factor, and so you can make a different decision about
Exactly.
that kind of thing.
Exactly. It doesn't just spontaneously happen. Like the vitamin K deficiency bleeding spontaneously happens and is terrifying. So, okay, there's that. Yeah, so thank you for that.
Did you know proper hydration and mineral balance are key for hormone health, fertility, and preparing for pregnancy? This is why Dr. Morgan and I love Relight by Redmond's, the real salt people. A USA-made electrolyte powder with unrefined sea salt, over 60 trace minerals, plus bioavailable forms of potassium, calcium, and two forms of magnesium, malate and glycinate. These minerals support hormones, hydration, energy, and overall health. The best part is they taste delicious. I'm really picky about how things taste, and so you can rest assured this is Dr. Leah approved. I love lemon lime, but I know Dr. Morgan is a strawberry lemonade gal. Head to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15% off your order of electrolytes, real sea salt, natural toothpaste, and so much more. Again, head to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15%. Happy hydrating on your womanhood and fertility journey.
Now, erythromycin, I goop stuff, is important in the case of if you have a gonorrhea, chlamydia, gonorrhea or chlamydia infection, specifically gonorrhea more is where it is effective, vaginal infection at the time of birth. They will give it to your baby within 1 to 2 hours of birth, if that's the case. And it's just an antibiotic ointment because gonorrhea bacteria in the eyes can cause blindness and it can happen really, really quickly. And it's very scary. So, yes, in that case, of course, we need it. The reason why they give it to every baby is because they're like, well, STD or STI status can change throughout the pregnancy. And maybe they were screened in the first trimester, but now they don't know if they have it and blah, 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 blah. So, like, let's just universally, again, this is public health. Let's just give it to every single baby and be done. Okay. The harms of erythromycin eye drop are very low. It is not an antibiotic, a systemic antibiotic. It is a local antibiotic ointment. But if you've ever used one, if you've ever had antibiotic ointment in your eye, it's very thick and goopy and you cannot see very well. So, although it is safe and there is low risk, the con to me is that if we don't need it, if you know you do not have this infection, again, why would we do it? If it's questionable, if we think maybe we have it, then sure, go for it. But if you know you do not have it, you and your partner have been faithful. You've had no other partner. You have no possible way of having an active gonorrhea or chlamydia infection at the time of birth. Why would we do it? And here's the downside to me is that newborns can't see very well anyways. And now we put this really thick goop in their eye for no reason. If there was a reason, okay, but if there's no reason, why would we make it even harder for them to bond and connect and be able to see their world and see their mom and potentially dad or other partner for those first couple hours of life if there isn't a reason? You know what I mean? I mean, we just come on. I don't know. I feel like this is all very logical, but again, it's public health versus individual health battle at all times. Okay, so there's that. It is safe if you want to do it, or if they just do it to your baby, it's like, okay, whatever. It's overall pretty low, but to me, it's just like, why? Unless we need to. Okay. The next one is the newborn metabolic screening, which I am so surprised. There are so many people that are like, no, I would never do that. They keep your baby's blood forever. And I'm like, I don't even care. I don't care if they keep my baby's blood forever. Why do I even care? Do I think that's weird? Yes. Like, what are you doing with that? And there is some evidence that maybe they do. They save those cards for like a long time that have these little blood circle dots on them. But here's the thing, the newborn metabolic screening, which is a heel prick to get some blood from your baby, is done between 24 and 48 hours. They have to wait at least 24 hours because the test isn't as accurate if they do it too early. And it checks for 35 core conditions and then 26 additional sort of secondary conditions. These are huge, big deal things that can change the trajectory of your child's life. They're overall rare, thank goodness, but they include things like certain endocrine, like, you know, congenital hypothyroidism, which, like, if is not caught, can cause, you know, devastating neurological defects for your baby. There's metabolic issues, including PKU. So sometimes people just call this test the PKU test because back in the day, that's all it really tested for, which is an issue where your baby cannot break down the amino acid called phenylalanine. And if that's true, then it's something that actually can be, like, really, not easily, but it can be managed through lifestyle and diet and sometimes medication where they're not going to have any of the devastating side effects. But if it's not caught, it can cause big, bad problems later on. It's going to check for blood pathologies or organic acid and fatty acid metabolism disorders, like a lot of different things that you're not going to just, like, see on your baby and know they have something wrong with them. This is, like, a very important, easy test to screen for things that could completely change the trajectory of your baby's life. And again, like, if something was positive on this test and you could have done something for your baby to have them not have severe brain damage or neurological or learning or whatever, different things, death potentially too, wouldn't you want to know that and have done that? Like, if you look retrospectively, your fear of them maybe saving the blood or doing the heel prick, and it's sad. I get it. It is sad. Then sometimes it's not, though. Sometimes the baby doesn't even seem like they notice the heel prick, and you can do it while you're nursing too. But to me, I'm just like, no, I recommend this for everybody. It's like a no-brainer. The downside of this is nil, like, if anything. So that's how I feel about that. Obviously pretty strong, but it just seems like such a duh, you know? Okay. The next one is testing blood sugar. So this is not going to be offered to every baby and shouldn't be. If it is offered to your baby and you don't think that there's a reason for this and you know that pretty well, you can just deny it. So, like, in a normal, healthy, full-term baby that's of, like, a normal weight for their age and they're feeding well, there's no reason to just randomly test the glucose of your child. If there is some situations where we maybe want to screen glucose, like if the baby is too small for their gestational age, which would mean they're, like, under 10% for their age, like a 6 pound, under a 6 pound, 41 or 42 week baby maybe needs to get checked. But if the baby's born at, like, 36 or 37 weeks, 6 pounds is pretty good. You know what I'm saying? So I can't just give a weight. People are gonna be like, well, what's the weight cutoff? And it's like, no, it doesn't. It has to do with the age of when they were born. So if they're under 10th percentile, or they're above the 90th percentile, those are situations where we may want to screen. If they are preterm, if the mother had any form of diabetes, so gestational diabetes or pre-diabetes, or, like, you know, pre-gestational diabetes, like they were diabetic prior to becoming pregnant, you know, whether it was type 1 or type 2, doesn't matter. Any form of diabetes in the pregnancy, that's the one that's, like, really makes the most sense, because the blood sugars may have been a little bit wonky and on the higher side. And during this transitional window, again, a transitional sacred window where baby is just trying as hard as they can to figure it out. Okay. And there's this nuance, this normal physiological low blood sugar that's to be expected as they're coming off. And this is happening in the first 1 to 2 hours of life, where they're coming off of having consistent placental glucose to now just intermittent feeds from breastfeeding. But the controversy is that there's people who fight this and they're like, well, what is normal and what is pathological? And so this is where you'll see differences in the guidelines. So if they're going to test you, usually they're going to test right at, like, the 1 hour after birthmark, 30 minutes after the first feed, and then usually before feeds for the next 12 to 24 hours and potentially even longer than that, if they think that, like, we need to, you know, keep going, or there's been, like, something a little sketchy with it. They should always start with oral glucose, like gels or different, or, you know, donor milk or different things like that before going into an IV form of glucose. And they usually do. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay. And then the next one is the CCHD test, which stands for the Critical Congenital Heart Disease Test. This is kind of along with like the hearing test, where very easy, if you're already in the hospital, extremely easy test to just do. And there's low intervention, there's no downside, like literally zero downside. If you're already in the hospital, just do it. Why not? And it's done again between, both of these tests are done between, well, no. The hearing test is done sooner. The hearing test is done between like 12 and 24 hours, and it takes like 10 to 20 minutes. It's so easy to do on a tiny little newborn because they are sleepy, and that's what we want is stillness. We want there to not be a lot of movement because of the way the sensors are. And the hearing test, people will be like, "Well, I know if my baby can hear." And I'm like, yeah, you clap and you can tell that it has what's called gross hearing, meaning like major hearing, gross motor skills, fine motor skills, right? Okay, so like gross hearing is not what we're testing for with a hearing test. What we're testing for with a hearing test is, can they perceive, can their brain perceive all tones, high to low on this huge long spectrum? Because if they can't, there is early intervention things we can do that can change the trajectory of their life with their own speech and understanding and learning and hearing abilities, like whether they need maybe hearing aids or cochlear implants later on or not. I mean, this is a big deal. I used to be a little bit more relaxed in my mindset around it. And then I had this long talk with an audiologist one time and my mind was blown. Like I did not, because they don't explain that to you when you're a parent. They don't explain why this is even important. And I don't know why they don't. Maybe they give you a pamphlet, but if somebody were to just have said the one sentence to me, which is, we're testing for tones that you can't even hear, but we perceive with the probes, is their brain picking up on it? Because it's important for the way that their entire rest of their life of talking and hearing and learning is going to go. I'd go, okay, yep, sign me up. Like, I
Yeah,
want.
wow.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're looking to see if the baby, like, obviously this is a joke. Like, they're not going to raise their hand, like you did the hearing test in school. They're like, raise your hand when you hear the beep.
Right. Yeah.
It's not like that. Like, the baby's not making any sense. They're doing a brain test, basically,
Yes, they put all these
is what you're
little
saying.
probes and sensors all over their head, and the baby's asleep. And they're picking up on, does the brain register this tone? Is there activity to show that it can hear it?
Right.
It takes like 10 to 20
That's
minutes. It's so
important.
easy. Now, if you do have a home birth or a birth center birth, you can go back to the hospital for this test at some point, or your midwife sometimes has all the equipment to be able to come and do it with you or for your baby. So that's really cool. Or there are state programs that can come to your house too, and it's very, very simple. I was blown away at how simple the state-based one coming to my house was. And I became like really good friends with the well, not really good friends, but I mean, I was so excited to see her. She came to my house twice and I forget why. Oh, she was also part of Idaho, and most states have some level of state-based program for babies who are maybe like, and kids who are on some sort of like a slower developmental thing. And we had Sunday signed up for this program, and it's free for some free PT sessions because her laryngeal malacia was so bad. And then her initial tummy time stuff was very weak. She was all hypotonic, like low tone. And anyway, it was the same lady who had come to my house for the hearing test. She was almost going to take one of Doug's puppies, is how like that all went down. But anyway, it was such a like wonderful, easy, simple experience. Now, the heart
That's
disease test
awesome.
is going to happen between 24 and 48 hours. So, on a little bit on the later end, and it's so easy. It's like they put one sensor on the baby's hand, one sensor on the opposite foot, and then they just sit there and they measure the oxygen saturation between the two. And what it's testing for is it's like a screening test for eight major cardiac anomalies that are, big deal things like tetralogy of Fallot and like transposition of the great vessels and things that would totally change the trajectory of your baby's life. Like, we need to know if this is going on. Maybe it was missed on ultrasound. Maybe you didn't have an ultrasound, whatever. These are things that the baby would be born with in the cardiac system that need attention and help. Again, zero downsides to doing this. And even that one, sometimes the midwives will have it and they can bring it to their house. Actually, most of the time, the midwives will bring that one to your house. The hearing test is kind of like iffy. Sometimes you might have to go to the hospital for the hearing test. And that is annoying. I get it. It's like to travel is rough, but there are these other systems where they can come to you. Okay, circumcision is a big one. So circumcision is done usually within 24 to 48 hours. Do we see how many things are happening on this like second day of life? It's a lot. And
Yeah,
And
that's a lot of decisions to make. And this is why it's so important to have these conversations ahead of time, especially something like circumcision, even though we should probably have a whole episode on circumcision. So maybe just speak about it briefly and we'll make a note to have a whole episode on that.
yeah, good point. Yeah, I'm not going to go into all the different things right now, but just know that most practitioners, pediatricians who are going to be doing it, won't do it with no vitamin K or just even oral. They'll want injectable. So that's one thing to consider. You can wait up to 2 weeks in most cases, and then some practitioners will do it between 4 and 6 weeks even. But after that, you're looking at a much more complicated procedure under general anesthesia done by a urologist. So most people are doing this, within the first couple of days of life of babies, life in the hospital. And or if they're born at home, then they're like taking them back to the hospital for the circumcision or to a pediatrician or to a, what do they call it, a moil or something. Okay, I have a confession to make that will probably knock the socks off of some of you crunchy moms. And please don't make fun of me for this, but listen, I don't make bone broth, okay? I don't. Sue me. I like to buy it instead. And maybe one day I'll get my act together, but for now I rely on brands like Fond to make real, actual bone broth from scratch, just the way that I would at home. Fond uses actual bones, not just rehydrated powders like a lot of brands. And their animals are verified regenerative, 100% grass-fed or pasture-raised, and the vegetables that they use are organic. And as you've heard us talk about in the past, there are certain foods like bone broth that have been used in pregnant and postpartum populations throughout human history, preferentially more so in those populations, due to their healing benefits on the body. So, providing the connective tissue nutrition or optimal gut health and healing so that our bodies can make new life healthfully. Fond has several different flavors to choose from in beef and chicken broth, from unflavored to things like the classic garlic and lemon to even a turmeric and black pepper with added health benefits. But then they also have foundational fats like tallow and lard as well. Make your family building season easy and choose Fond for your shelf-stable glass bottled bone broth that you can use in soups, with rice, or just for sipping like I do because they taste that good. Check the link in the show notes or go to fondregenerative.com and use code HAAM HAM for 10% off and nourish yourself with Fond. Yeah, so I mean that's you just have to decide. Yeah, well you're right. Let's just wait. I do talk more about circumcision in my course and all sorts of different things. But okay. The next one is bilirubin and jaundice. So this is a big one because this can be really confusing for people. Actually, let me skip this and let's talk about the others really quick that are quicker and then we'll end on jaundice because it's a big topic. So the next one is the early bath. And this used to be where it was always like within 1 to 2 hours of birth, they used to like fully bathe your baby and then again swaddle them and wrap them in the hat and then hand them back to you as this like perfect little new shiny package. Now, nowadays, what we're seeing a lot of is like they're waiting at least 6 hours, if not 24 hours, before offering to do it in the hospital. Again, at home in a birth center is going to be a very, very different situation. My recommendation is to wait 7 to 10 days before bathing your baby because there's a lot of, yeah, okay, if they have crusty blood or something like that in their hair or behind their ears or I don't know, something, there's vernix. First of all, vernix you can just rub in or you can just towel it off. Some babies are born like completely covered as if like a whole bottle of lotion spilled on them. I get it. You're going to probably want to wipe off some of that and then you can rub the rest of it in. But bathing a baby with soap has literally no benefit. And I know this is also cultural because I got yelled at on social media a lot one time when I was suggesting this waiting 7, 10, 14 days to bathe the baby. Because people are like, that's disgusting. Like, why would you do that? And the reason is for colonization of their microbiome. It's actually like a totally logical, physiological, and known thing that when a baby comes out, whether they're vaginal or cesarean, and they're on your skin-to-skin chest, and they're nursing, they're getting a huge amount of bacterial input and being colonized for the very first time. And that's great. And we want that. We want them to saturate and sit in that. Vernix has many benefits to the baby's skin. And so toweling it all the way off, rubbing it completely off instead of in, has no benefit. Why? Like,
Yeah.
don't
And
nobody
the
questions.
one thing I want to say, yeah, the one thing I want to say is if you do feel worried, you can always wash their genitals
Yes.
because I kind of wish that I had done that. I also did the delayed bath and my son ended up getting a UTI and who knows what it would have been from, but I feel like you can always just like wash their genitals, but I don't even wash my body with soap. Like I wash my pits and parts But I'm not like scrubbing my arms with soap, unless I actually was dirty from like mud. It's not something that our body needs. It dries your skin out, it changes all sorts of stuff. But if you want to wash like their genitals, but then leave the rest of their body, I think that's like a perfect compromise because then you're washing the parts that are actually like, potentially full of bacteria or whatever.
True, true, totally. But I do want to clarify, he didn't get a UTI at birth. He was like 3 or 4 months old, right?
Yeah, he was like 6 weeks old.
Oh, 6 weeks. Oh, wow. Really that young? Jeez.
Yeah.
That is the
That's why we
one
had to go to the
downside of not circumcising is there is a slightly higher UTI risk in little boys. Obviously, little boys, because
Yeah, so
they
just
are the
maybe
only ones that
being,
get circumcised.
more careful with the baths around that part. That's the only thing I would say is just like if I could go back, I'd probably be better about that,
And
but
who knows if it even would have
it's all
affected
good.
things, but
I
yeah.
know. It's like who knows?
No one
Who
has a
knows?
crystal ball.
I know.
Okay, but so there's that. Yeah, there is benefit to letting your baby soak in their colonization and just they're really not like dirty. Yeah, if like they're a big blowout diaper, yeah, you want to rinse it in the sink. Okay, go for it. Whatever. They have blood chunks in their hair or like vernix chunks or things in their hair, then you can take a little wet washcloth and wipe that out. But again, they don't need like a full head to toe soapy scrub. Actually, really ever. And I don't really do that with my babies ever. I will just wash their hair and then their genitals when I'm even doing baths, which is, on the rarer end. But anyway, okay, so potentially some labs that are like a maternal lab thing that might affect the baby is if you were GBS positive, whether or not you did antibiotics, they're going to be monitoring the baby a little bit more for infection. So maybe taking more temperature reads, things like that. If you were RH negative and your partner was RH positive, this is like a Rogam conversation. They can always do an Eldon card on the baby and find out the baby's blood type. And if the baby is positive and you as the mom are negative, they're going to offer you Rogam after birth. And so maybe they're going to want to, like in that setting, they might want to do one additional heel prick, which is for the Eldon card to find out the baby's blood type. Or they can milk it from the cord if you did not do delayed cord clamping. But you need to be like really on that though, because that you just have a couple seconds really to make that decision after the baby's born. So it needs to be talked about beforehand. If you were HIV positive, then your baby's going to be getting prophylaxis. And same thing, if you were a Hep B positive, there is a hemoglobin or sorry, an immunoglobulin that your baby can get. In addition to the hepatitis B vaccine, they will also get a hepatitis B immunoglobulin to help them deal with so that they don't actually have any re repercussions from being born of a hepatitis B positive mom. Okay.
That's great.
Okay, now let's go to jaundice. So jaundice is the yellowing that we sometimes see in like the whites of babies' eyes and on their skin is the buildup of bilirubin. Bilirubin comes from the breakdown of red blood cells. That sounds scary, but we are breaking down red blood cells all the time, constantly. And newborns have like a ton of red blood cells and they break them down very quickly. And normally the liver goes and deals with it and it's no big deal, but their liver is immature. And they're not really pooping that often, which is it's a gastrointestinal pooping detoxification process. So it goes to the liver, then it would go to the guts, and then it would be like get bound up in stool and be pooped out. But they're not really pooping that much. They have all this extra red blood cell stuff, and then a liver that can't really handle it. Okay, so we see that this is like a physiological process, and this is what we call physiologic jaundice. And it shows up on day like 2 to 3. Most of the time, it will resolve in a week or two. We don't need to do anything about it. It's like a spectrum. There's going to be a lot of babies that get to this to an extent, and they don't need treatment. The concern is that if it's bad, if the bilirubin is really high and really bad, and it's like not going down, is that if the bilirubin gets up to the brain, it can cause brain damage. It can cause an encephalitis. It's very rare for this to happen, but that's the main concern. So there's a screening test called the TCB, which is the transcutaneous bilirubin, which they basically just take this little light and they put it up to the skin. And if it's high, what they are reading, it's a very easy, non-invasive screening test. If it's high, then they go on to do the blood test to check for serum bilirubin. Okay, so there's like a little bit of a progression there, which I highly suggest doing. If we're concerned about this, we do it. Delayed cord clamping, as I had mentioned earlier, it doesn't meaningfully change these jaundice numbers. You'd think, okay, yeah, but you're giving the baby so much more blood, and then there's red blood cells and blah 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 blah. And what about the bilirubin and da da? Okay, here's the thing. Still, even if it was a little bit higher, the benefits of hemoglobin and iron stores from 3 to 6 months are, and all lots of other things, trump any of these like negative potential increased jaundice risk. So delayed cord clamping is still recommended. Okay, the jaundice testing is going to happen at, again, 24 to 48 hours. And if we need to do something, this is where you see the little babies in the blue light, like boxes, basically, with glasses on, and their like skin is getting blue light because the blue light will help to convert and break down that bilirubin through the skin. Isn't this so cool? This is why we know that light is so important on physiology.
So
It
cool.
goes through the skin and it breaks it down into a water soluble version. Excuse me, that then can just be peed out instead of having to be pooped out because newborns aren't really pooping that much. And so now there's two other forms of jaundice, which you might hear. This is physiologic jaundice. This is like it's over within a week or two. Most kids are not going to need any help with this. Now you're going to hear about two other ones that have to do with breastfeeding. And it's a little bit of one of those like, what's the word? It's like I think the formula companies probably love these two terms. Because it scares people thinking that breast milk is not enough or breast milk is the cause. And it's like, no, we need to just rename them or something. So the first is breastfeeding jaundice. And this is just simply from not enough milk. If you don't have enough milk, your baby has low intake for some reason. And this would happen like somewhere between days 2 and 5 when they should be getting like milk. You know, it's transitioning from colostrum into regular white milk. If they're getting not enough, you're not going to make stool, right? And so this bilirubin that's getting pushed into the gut, now it's sitting there and it's not coming out in stool because there's just simply not enough volume. And so it's getting reabsorbed back into the bloodstream. So now you still have these high circulating bilirubin levels, okay? This is why we talk about how constipation is bad for detoxification. You need to be having really good poops to be able to detox because if you don't, and all these toxins are just sitting in your gut, they're not getting pooped out, they get reabsorbed. And bilirubin is a really good example of that. So they get reabsorbed back into the bloodstream. Okay, so breastfeeding jaundice is an easy, quick fix. Feed the baby more, figure out the latch, get donor milk, something for this period of time. I cannot believe actually that Gage did not have a jaundice issue because he was not getting enough milk.
There's probably some genetic component too.
There's different risk factors. Okay, and then the next one is breast milk jaundice. Okay, so there's breastfeeding jaundice and breast milk jaundice. Breastfeeding, you want to think about feeding. Okay, they're just not feeding enough. Breast milk jaundice is that there are, so the baby is feeding well, gaining weight well, they're pooping well, they're thriving. Okay, but there are some aspects of breast milk which do increase the rate of that gut absorption of bilirubin for some reason. And so the bilirubin does stay elevated in their blood a little bit longer. It tends to start closer to the end of the first week. And it peaks around like 2 weeks, okay? But it can last actually up to 12 weeks. So for the first 3 months, potentially the baby's life, it's just a much slower clearing of bilirubin. But it's not like it's continuing to go up and up and up. It's just that, and the baby's thriving otherwise. It's just that it's a little bit prolonged and it's no worries. We don't need to do anything unless your baby's symptoms start to change. They become lethargic, they start feeding poorly. Now we may need to go and get lab testing. But just know that like some babies rock with this, like, low level of jaundice for up to 3 months when they're exclusively breastfed, and it is okay. Okay.
That's
The
good to know.
yes, so good to know. Okay. The very last one is I get asked this all the time, which is, do I go to the pediatric well child check appointments if I'm not doing vaccines or I'm doing a delayed schedule? What's the point? Okay. Yes, I think you do still go to them. You don't have to go to every single one. Sometimes they do feel a bit excessive. It's like every month or so, it's a lot, but you need
It is a
to.
lot.
For a couple of different reasons, because there's things that the pediatrician will do and check on your baby that you're just not aware of as a parent, unless you're like a pediatrician. So, the hip dysplasia test and checking the red light reflex in their eye, and just stuff that, again, could have really big repercussions if it's not caught early. Because, as with everything with kids, early intervention is going to be the best route. I do understand that there's a lot of fear of the practitioner like reporting you or pushing back and shaming you or not wanting to be your doctor anymore because you're not getting vaccines. And it takes a little bit of shopping around to find somebody who's going to be supportive of that. And it also depends on your state. In certain times, California was really locked down on this, and pediatricians were not even accepting patients that were not agreeing to the full CDC schedule, which I think is nuts. That does not serve people. There are people who are going to refuse vaccines for religious reasons, for philosophical reasons, for whatever reason. to deny them care because they're not going to follow along with your narrative is nuts. You should give them informed consent and know that they are taking a risk. And yes, there is this herd immunity, public health idea that potentially they're putting other people at risk. And this is a free country, okay? So people are always going to be making these decisions. You cannot deny them care because they're not going to follow. It's insane. It has to do with insurance too. But okay, another reason is that like not only will they catch things that you can't, but what about like an emergency? What if something does happen and you need to be able to take your baby and there's some kind of crazy rash and a fever and you're very nervous, or your baby's got croup all of a sudden, or your baby is like acting strange, and what do you just want to take them straight to the emergency room all the time? Like, what if you need, I mean, yeah, if it's an emergency, but okay, what if they have an ear infection and you need to get them checked out, and now you don't have an established pediatrician to go to? So there's that reason. And then there's the reason of the paper trail, which is simply that, yeah, if something were to come up later and there was no trail of your baby going and seeing medical professionals, that doesn't really bode well in the legal system. They want to see that you're taking them and being a responsible parent and showing care, even though sometimes people don't take their pediatrician because there's the fear of the system and they're doing very well at home and they're very loving and caring parents. The state can't see that, they don't see what you're doing at home necessarily. So anyway, there is lots of different reasons why you should go, in my opinion. And again, I'll reiterate, as we did earlier in the episode, that fear of this system entirely is still a fear-based mindset. And you can pick and choose, and you can be very grounded in your choices and, potentially come armed with like some studies to show your pediatrician if they're going to be, I don't know, combative to you. The pediatrician that I had in San Diego was so wonderful with Gage. I wanted to start vaccines at 6 months with him, and I was in such a poor headspace my whole first year of motherhood that every time I'd go into the appointments, I would just tell him, I would just bawl. I would just start crying, bawling, crying. Cause I was like, I meant to do more research and I did it and I'm sorry. And like, I'm just not ready. And he would be like, it's okay. Like, oh, it's gonna make me start crying thinking about it. He'd be like, it's okay. This time I would suggest like this and this and this. And then because you didn't do these ones, like it'll shunt these ones to this. He would draw out this like little chart. And he was just so wonderful. Like, he'd been a pediatrician for like 35 years. And I would just be like, okay. He's like, oh, I'm just gonna chart it in your notes that like, we talked about it and you're just not ready and we'll talk about it again next time. I was like, thank you. You're so sweet. He knew nothing about breastfeeding, literally nothing at all. He knew nothing about diet and nutrition at all. I remember one time I came back and all of the best year students started taking their kids to him because he was so just like understanding of different choices around vaccines. But like somebody had given him a book about fats, about saturated fat and cholesterol and stuff, and it was like the first time he'd ever heard about some of these higher nutrition topics, and he was like mind blown. And so he's like, do you know about this? And I was like, yeah.
Oh my gosh,
But he was,
so
he was
funny.
changing and trying and, learning based on his population too. It was very sweet. So they're not all big bad guys, and you can find a functional medicine practitioner, a naturopathic doctor, somebody who is just willing. And even if they're not, it's like, you can just tell them, listen, please respect my decision and choice. I know that it's different from you. I really hear you. Please give me your informed consent. I will sit here and I will, because you also might learn something. There's a lot of mommy bloggers that think that they know every single thing about vaccines, and they are wrong. They are wrong a lot of the time. They say crazy shit, you guys. It's nuts. The internet is the wild, wild west, and AI is no better. Okay. So they are just straight up wrong. They will say crazy things. I'm like, that is not even true. What are you saying? And some of it is so fringy and so out there and wackadoo. I understand the vaccine hesitancy, and I think the schedule is nuts. Yeah, we need to change the schedule for sure. And I know it maybe did just change. I don't know. I've not kept up on it. But it's also not like, I don't know. I just, being in the natural world, you sort of get shunted into these other subculture groups where you see like what other people are talking about, and it's like, wow, this is just, you don't see any benefit. They're like, they don't see any benefit whatsoever sometimes of how these things can help. And I'm just like, I don't know how you could not see that. Like, you don't. The idea of vaccination is wonderful and amazing and beautiful. The problem is that with the adjuvants and the immune activation, it's causing some problems for some kids. And to not recognize that is also crazy and so stupid. And it's like, these conventional pediatricians who won't just come out and recognize that are losing people left and right, dropping like flies, because we are not stupid. We see it with our eyes. We know what's going on. Why can someone not just recognize we need to do things a little better? We should figure out a different way. Like, yeah, there's problems with this system. Here's the informed consent. They don't do it. They don't want to do it.
And everything is just, everything is just not so black and white. Yeah. That's the whole thing. Our whole podcast, if I had to boil our whole podcast down to one sentence, it's that we are not extreme on any spectrum and it is not black and white and it just depends.
Yep. It's crazy. It's just what it is. I don't know. So anyway, I hope you guys learned a lot in this.
That was a whole course, like literally a whole course. You guys support our sponsors, support us. Consider joining your pregnancy call. It's so good.
Yeah. If you like this, if you like the way that we teach and learn and you want to know things, you're going to be getting pregnant or you are pregnant, check out my pregnancy call, because in the pregnancy class, it is so much more than whatever it is that you're thinking that it is. It's not. It's so much more. And I am realizing that in all the feedback I get from the people that take it, that I don't know how well to explain what all you're getting. It's really difficult. Like, how do I explain it? So just trust. Okay. And we'll see you guys next week.
Come in. Feet first.
Yay. Bye. Are you pregnant or you're trying to conceive and you're looking for reliable natural health information about how to have a healthy pregnancy and also prepare for the future steps in motherhood to come, like the birth, the breastfeeding, and the postpartum? Because I have got you. So this is exactly the reason why I made the 6-week pregnancy call. And it's my most comprehensive resource. It's the thing that I absolutely love. I've poured my heart and soul into it. It's all of the things that I wish that every woman knew when they are entering motherhood. It's a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 class, and a postpartum planning course all in one. And normally I run it as a class with live Q&A calls, but now it's available in a content-only format so that you can purchase it at any time and start learning immediately. It's called the lessons-only format, and it is just only all of the video lessons that you'll get access to for forever. So log on to milkmedicine.com/lessons-only or check out the link in the show notes.
In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and share with a friend who would benefit from this content. Please remember that the views and ideas from this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis and treatment of any disease. Consult with your provider before integrating any of this information into your own healthcare plan. A healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.